From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, using human rights and rule of law and combating violent extremism. The AJC linking European and Jewish security following terror attacks. Striking back at the modern iGorilla.
We've taken network to fight a network. We use an iForce.
And a U.S. court overturns the conviction of an Australian former Guantanamo detainee. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yockey. An influential Egyptian research institution is urging U.S. President Barack Obama to emphasize human rights and the rule of law in any strategy to combat violent extremism. The call by the Cairo Institute for Human Rights Studies comes at a time of fast-paced developments in the battle against extremist violence. President Obama is hosting a White House summit on the subject this week. At the same time, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is urging the United Nations to endorse an international military campaign against the extremist group that claims to have executed 21 Egyptian Christians in Libya. Samer Shahada is a political scientist at the University of Oklahoma. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with him about the recent rise of extremist violence in Egypt and the surrounding region.
Professor Shahada, 4 years after ousting former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, how would you describe the situation in Egypt right now?
The situation in Egypt right now is quite far from democracy and quite far from what the millions of protesters had hoped when they ousted Mr. Mubarak. They wanted a democratic Egypt, an Egypt where there was social justice, economic opportunities, and growth, and for people to be treated with dignity by the government. And unfortunately, none of that has materialized. There are thousands of people in prison. The democratic system is not transparent and open. The society is deeply polarized. And there are multiple parties to blame between those who support the current government and those who are critical of it, particularly Islamists and the Muslim Brotherhood. So these are very difficult times in Egypt presently.
Where do you expect Egypt to be heading after the upcoming parliamentary elections being the so-called final step in the roadmap?
Well, I don't think that the situation is going to change significantly or improve, really, as a result of the upcoming parliamentary elections scheduled for March 2015. I think what everyone can agree on is that any parliament that is elected is not going to be a powerful parliament, a powerful check to the power of the president, the general-turned-president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who has, of course, the backing of the military and the security apparatus, and also millions of people behind him. So, unfortunately, that kind of check and balance or a counterbalance isn't going to be realized. It doesn't look like there are going to be powerful political parties that emerge that win significant number of votes. And even if they do, it doesn't look like they're going to be able to stand up to President Sisi.
The economic situation seems to be the most challenging problem facing Egypt 4 years after the popular uprising. What's your assessment of the Egyptian government handling of this problem?
I think that the most pressing problem, really, is a political problem, and that the economics comes afterwards. Well, I'll speak about economics in a moment, but I think that the society is incredibly polarized, incredibly divided. There's a great deal of repression and also insecurity. As you know, there are, unfortunately, acts of terrorism and killing. Hundreds of members of the security forces have been killed. There's an insurgency going on in Sinai and so on. So I think the political situation is foremost, but you are right. The economic situation is also very important, and this government has tried to undertake some economic reform measures. They, of course, reduced fuel subsidies some months back. They've issued a new system of subsidies, unlike the blanket subsidies of many years where everybody would be able to obtain, for example, subsidized bread and some other commodities. Now there's a system that's more targeted towards those who have lower incomes. And this seems to be winning praise from the International Monetary Fund and other institutions. And there's money coming in from the Gulf countries. But the real structural change that's needed, a fundamental change that really produces improvement in human quality of life, but for the majority of Egyptians, I think is still far away. Because unless you deal with the political issues, unless you deal with systematic corruption, unless you invest, you know, significant resources in education and health, you really aren't going to see a qualitative change. And we don't see any realization even of the magnitude of the scale of the problems that Egypt faces.
Final question. What needs to be done for a better transition to democracy in Egypt? And do you see any role for the U.S. or the international community in helping Egypt moving toward democracy?
Well, the things that need to be done and which will not be done, of course, are a peaceful, inclusive, democratic process in the context of institutions. And here I mean a constitution and laws that provide equality of citizenship and a protection of rights for all Egyptians, whether they're Christian or Muslim, men or women, rich or poor, young and old, and so on. So that's not going to happen, unfortunately, because what we have is really the dominance of the political and economic system by some elements in society to the exclusion and detriment, I think, of many others. Now, what will the United States do? The United States also has been quite poor in its willingness to stand up for principles, principles of democracy, principles of the right of peaceful protest, of due justice and process of law, and so on. I mean, there are dozens of journalists in jail, as I said, thousands of political prisoners. But the United States has largely, despite occasional rhetoric, been willing to do business with Egypt, business as usual, that is, supplying military aid, supplying attack helicopters, and supplying some political cover, and not pressing enough for the basic rights and freedoms that I think all people deserve.
Samer Shahada with the University of Oklahoma. Two recent terrorist attacks have followed a similar pattern. First in France, deadly attacks on the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine and on a kosher grocery. Then in Denmark, bloody attacks on a free speech seminar and later on a synagogue. The second is not officially being called a copycat assault, but has heightened concern among the Jewish community. David Harris is executive director of the American Jewish Committee in New York. We asked him the effects of these raids.
It creates tremendous fear and anxiety, questions about the future for Jews in Europe, but it also creates uncertainty about Europe itself and the future of the continent. As you said in your introduction, there's a linkage. There were attacks on European values, such as freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and there were attacks on Jews. In other words, there were attacks on Europe and what it stands for. So the future is in question both for Jews and, frankly, for Europe itself.
Well, what steps are needed to protect your community? What can be done?
A lot. I've been spending the last 15 years, that's 15 years, together with my AJC colleagues, traveling in Europe, meeting with European leaders, and trying to call attention to the growing threat both to Jewish communities and to European values. And we got a mixed reaction, always polite, but in many cases a reaction of denial. Now Europe has to face the magnitude of the problem. There is a threat. It comes from within Europe, and it comes from the periphery of Europe. Europe has to acknowledge the threat, call it by its real name, which is jihadist radicalism, Islamic radicalism, and it has to strengthen its will and its determination on many, many fronts, from intelligence and surveillance to justice, to the police, to education, to take on this challenge. And it won't be an overnight issue. It's not about one speech or two speeches. It's about a long-term determination to defend Europe's values and Europe's communities, including Jews, in order to save Europe.
Sometimes, though, when they try to improve the situation, they can actually take away some rights that people have. It's a fine line there.
Well, there is a fine line, but the first line and the first right is the right to security and the right to life. And right now, the right to security and the right to life are both being threatened, as we've seen now in Belgium, in France, in Denmark, and elsewhere. And Europe is under threat. And when you add to this the fact that there are now an estimated 3,000-plus Europeans currently fighting in Iraq and in Syria, The European fear is what happens when they return to Europe. They will be battle-hardened, battle-tested, and are they going to go back to peaceful pursuits, or are they going to carry on their jihadist struggle within Europe? So this is an immense challenge. Europe is a democratic zone. It need not apologize for its democracy, but it also has to defend itself and its core values, which are under assault.
You mentioned what the authorities should do, but is there anything within your community that you can do other than visiting and talking with people?
Well, the Jewish community, acting on its own, can do very little. It's a small minority of Europe. What it can do, though, is continue to urge European authorities to provide full protection, full security, and full support. And many European countries today are waking up to that reality. I would particularly point to France, which took a while to figure out the challenge, but the Prime Minister of France today is probably the most determined and courageous of European leaders who understands, and he has said that France without the Jews is no longer France. And I would add, Europe without the Jews would no longer be Europe. So the future of Europe and the future of Jewish communities in Europe are completely intertwined. You can't separate one from the other. So Jewish security depends on European security, and European security, I would argue, also depends on Jewish security.
David Harris, Executive Director of the American Jewish Committee in New York. John Sutherland, a senior analyst with the Department of Defense and author, was speaking with us Tuesday about a new face of war, the iGuerrilla. He says they are part of the younger generation that is competent with the new social media and organized as a virtual network. Today we ask, how do we fight an iGuerrilla?
Well, in my opinion, and I say in my book, we take a network to fight a network. We use an I-force, enabling our troops to swarm. And the way we would do that, and we actually have experimented with it, and in 2006 in the city of Mosul, it happened as a consequence of just trying to survive, and it turned out to be very successful. So what we did was you push power down to the lower levels, battalions, companies, sometimes even platoons, and they're allowed to make their decisions at the lower level. They also share their missions and their targets with other units in the area. Like an Army unit could share with a Special Forces unit, and likewise could share with a Marine unit. So they all kind of know what each other is doing. And when they engage, they can actually collaborate directly at the lower level. The way the military was built was to fight conventional wars against the major army. And so things going up the chain, decisions made there and then coming back down made sense. But the fight is really dynamic now. It's more like cops on the beat, so that each troop out there needs to be able to call for higher-level support, like air or artillery, and direct them immediately at the lowest level. And we've done that, and what we need to do now is kind of codify that, train that, and be prepared to use that as a way to fight these guerrilla-type wars.
Well, tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, I open up with describing how and why things changed. And I really think it goes back to the collapse of the Soviet Union back in 1991. Back in the Cold War days, everybody pretty much had to take sides. You were either with the Russians, the Soviets, or you were with the Americans, the capitalists. And any event, any incident had the potential of escalating into a nuclear face-off between those two great powers, superpowers. And because of that, everybody in the world, whether they liked it or not, they were aligned and they had to keep their radicals under wraps because nobody wanted to be the ones who caused, you know, a face-off. And so everything was monitored and regulated and tracked. Trade, travel, communications, exchange of information, all that stuff was controlled very tightly. I don't think you ever would have seen a 9/11 during the Cold War or an attack on a theater in Moscow during the Cold War. But once the Soviet Union collapsed, all the old motivations for war were unleashed. We saw that with the collapse of the old Soviet Union. There was a dozen or so former Soviet republics that left, and they did so based on ethnic nationalism. And ethnic nationalism was not allowed to be a motive for war during the Cold War days. So anyways, I think the collapse of the Soviet Union opened up all these new motivations for war, whether they were ethnic, or sectarian based on religion. So I describe how that changed. And with the globalization, the liberalization of and democratization of travel, knowledge, sharing knowledge, information, communications, it unleashed a whole set of tools that all these new movements could put into work. And so it describes how the insurgents in the world kind of gradually woke up to the fact that they could travel around easily. They could talk across borders easily. And by using the internet, they could recruit indirectly rather than going face-to-face. And local causes could be turned into global causes. And so all these things kind of roll together, kind of super empowering these small groups that back in the old days would have been marginalized, very local, back-of-the-newspaper type of event.
Author and senior analyst with the Defense Department, John Sutherland. He stresses that his views are his own, not the government's. The book, iGuerrilla, Reshaping the Face of War in the 21st Century, is to be released in March. A U.S. military appeals court has overturned the conviction of an Australian man who was held in Guantanamo Bay and found guilty years ago of material support for a terrorist organization. David Hicks has told a news conference in Sydney that he did not intend to seek an official apology or compensation for his 5.5-year ordeal in the U.S. prison camp in Cuba. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
David Hicks was the first person to be convicted at a U.S. war crimes trial since the Second World War. The former kangaroo hunter was captured with Taliban forces in Afghanistan in late 2001. He was held at Guantanamo Bay from January 2002 until May 2007, when he pleaded guilty to providing material support to terrorism. In a plea bargain, all but 9 months of his sentence were suspended, and he was allowed to return home to Australia, where he was imprisoned until the end of his term behind bars. On Wednesday, a U.S. military appeals court threw out his conviction because the activity for which he was found guilty didn't become a crime until years after he was captured in Afghanistan. The 39-year-old Hicks spoke to the media at a news conference in Sydney on Thursday.
I'm sure no one is surprised by today's long-awaited acknowledgement by the government of the United States of America of my innocence. Even the Australian government has admitted that I had committed no crime. It's just unfortunate that because of politics, I was subjected to 5.5 years of physical and psychological torture that I will now live with always.
David Hicks has rarely spoken in public and remains a polarising figure. To some Australians, he's a traitor who admitted supporting extremism, while others believe he's a victim of rough justice. In 2000, Hicks was in Pakistan, where he trained with the militant group Lashkar-e-Toiba, which was later designated by Washington as a foreign terrorist organization. Hicks travelled to Afghanistan in early 2001 and attended a training camp run by Al-Qaeda. Following the September 11, 2001 attacks, he was captured in Baglan, Afghanistan, by Northern Alliance fighters and turned over to the United States. He was among the first group of prisoners transferred to Guantanamo Bay. His father, Terry, who's long campaigned on his son's behalf, says there will be some Australians who won't accept the court's decision.
We're still going to have the people out there that are going to say, who cares whether he's been found not guilty? As far as they're concerned, he is. But that's their way of going about things. From our point of view, the courts have said he's not guilty, and that's what we accept, and it's a great feeling.
Australia has been accused in the past of doing little to help one of two of its citizens who were held at Guantanamo Bay. Asked about the overturning of David Hicks' terror-related conviction, Prime Minister Tony Abbott said the nation shouldn't fret about an old terrorist threat, but to focus on current dangers. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On February 19, 1473, Polish astronomer Nicholas Copernicus was born. He is recognized as the first European scientist to espouse a heliocentric or sun-centered view of Earth's solar system. On this day in 1674, the Treaty of Westminster was signed, ending the Third Anglo-Dutch War. Among the treaty's provisions was official Dutch relinquishment of its former settlement, New Amsterdam, to the English. That settlement was located in parts of the modern-day state of New York. On this day in 1777, the Continental Congress passed over Brigadier General Benedict Arnold for a promotion. In 1780, the resentful Arnold betrayed his country by offering to hand over a fort at West Point, New York, to the British. Arnold's plot failed, and he is today known as one of history's most notorious traitors. In 1807, former U.S. Vice President Aaron Burr was arrested for allegedly committing treason following a mysterious plot that supposedly involved establishing a separate republic on either U.S. or Spanish-held territory. Burr was later cleared of the charge. In 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, 2 months after the Japanese attack on U.S. bases in Hawaii. It led to the removal of thousands of West Coast Japanese Americans and immigrants of Japanese ancestry to internment camps. In 1943, German General Erwin Rommel's Africa Corps launched an offensive against Allied forces in Tunisia, leading to the United States' first major defeat in battle during the Second World War. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Jordan is a stable, moderate presence in a turbulent part of the world and remains a critical partner for the United States on a range of issues, including the Syrian crisis, the Middle East peace process, and countering violent extremism. The United States and Jordan share a commitment to promoting regional security and stability, furthering Jordan's economic development, and advancing social, political, and economic reform in Jordan. We recognize Jordan's increased immediate needs resulting from regional unrest, the efforts Jordan is undertaking at the forefront of the fight against ISIL and other extremist ideology and terrorism, the influx of hundreds of thousands of refugees from Syria and Iraq, the disruption of foreign energy supplies, and other unprecedented strains. According to Jordan's foreign minister, Nasser Judeh, Jordan is hosting about 800,000 registered refugees and some 700,000 economic migrants. This means that the refugee population in Jordan stands at approximately 21% of the overall population, and in the words of Foreign Minister Judeh, is something that no country, regardless of political or economic might, can cope with. Consequently, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Foreign Minister Judeh signed a new memorandum of understanding that reflects our strategic partnership and the United States' firm commitment to Jordan's stability. In the past 5 years, the level of assistance in this memorandum was $600 million annually. Starting now and continuing through 2017, that level will go up sharply to $1 billion a year, which covers a wide range of programs in the areas of economic support, technical help, and security, said Secretary Kerry. The increase from the previous MOU is designed to address Jordan's short-term extraordinary needs, including those related to regional instability and rising energy costs. The provisions of this memorandum will strengthen the forces of civility and moderation everywhere, said Secretary Kerry, because it will bolster a country and a leadership team that has been steadfast in its support for both.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.